Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest, or as the case may be, guests, to pick one, or as the case may be, two, movies from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about those movies. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hall.
Today marks a first, as you may have guessed from the intro, two of them actually. For the first time, we have two guests, and we're covering two movies in a grindhouse-style double feature that very likely did in fact play together on more than one occasion. Our first guest is the New York Times bestselling author of How to Sell a Haunted House, The Final Girl Support Group, The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires, We Sold Our Souls, My Best Friend's Exorcism, Horror Store, and Paperbacks from Hell. His books have sold over 2 million copies and been translated into more than 20 languages. Our second guest is a librarian, writer, and film historian who edited the fanzine Temple of Schlock from 1987 to 1991 and brought it on back as a blog in 2008. He's written about film for numerous magazines, websites, and physical media releases. And they're here with us to talk about the new, revised, and expanded edition of their absolutely indispensable book, These Fists Break Bricks, How Kung Fu Movies Swept America and Changed the World. Please welcome two personal heroes, Grady Hendrix and Chris Pagali. Hello, gents.
Hello.
Thanks for having us, dude. And yeah. I will just say, Chris, this book would not have happened without Chris. Chris is an insane researcher to a point of like, I think he like, you know, he doesn't have a normal life. He researches. And I now actually pay Chris to research shit for me because he's so much better than I am.
I don't have trouble believing that. My introduction to Chris was actually via the audio commentaries on the 42nd Street Forever DVDs, yep. Which if you guys haven't seen them, like, this is like, you know, 2.5-3 hour disc with like dozens upon dozens of trailers. And, you know, I'm listening to him and Mike Gingold, like every 3 minutes, there's a new movie that they're just rapid fire information, can tell you who was in it, who directed it, which studio it came from, what other titles it was like. It's like a download of information when you're listening.
Audio commentary for a trailer Blu-ray with Chris and Mike. And oh, I never felt more like a third wheel. It was like the dude in the threesome who's contributing nothing. And eventually he's like, can I just get everyone a cold drink? Like, it was like awesome. A buzzsaw. It was amazing.
That is awesome. So These Fists Break Bricks was my favorite film book of 2021 in its original edition. And which I feel like I should contextualize that praise by pointing out that I put out a film book in 2021 and one was still my favorite. So let's start with the key question for those of us who got it the first time around. What have you revised and expanded in this revised and expanded edition?
Chris, take it.
Well, we started out by putting in some material that had been cut from the first edition, and then we just went a little crazy adding more and more like new material. So there's a section on video labels. There's more information on Jackie Chan. There's some additional information on Jet Li and Donnie Yen. There's some
Tiger that, Yang and the ab flex.
Yep. that was something that had been cut from the first edition. There was a whole section on paperbacks, like martial arts, men's adventure paperbacks.
Paperbacks, you say? Yep. Interesting.
Totally cut. But yeah. That's Chris's section. Like he wrote this huge chunk about Kung Fu paperbacks, and it was just, you know, we had to lose like 8 pages. Right. So it was out. Now it's back in.
Nice. Nice. Well, it really is. It's such a rich text. It is loaded with information. I knew next to none of it. It's that, you know, this, there's an entire history here that's not really part of the standard film text, or if anything, it's just sort of mentioned in passing in, you know, parentheticals or footnotes. So I'm curious to know about the initial conception and evolution of the book, if any, like how it came to be, and was it always going to be in this form and format as it came out?
Well, so Chris had read Paperbacks from Hell, which is the book I did on horror paperbacks right. in the 70s and 80s. And he was like, listen, I've got this huge collection of posters. Would there be a way to do a book like Paperbacks from Hell about the posters? He's like, I was thinking of doing an art book. I think, Chris, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was like, well, let's talk. And so we started talking, and you already had some of the essential stuff. Because like some of the key people, Larry Joaquin, Terry Levine, Seraphim Care Alexis, these indie producer distributors, like those were really key interviews Chris had already done. He'd already dug up the beginning of the stuff about Karate Hand of Death, which turned out to be a Department of Defense intelligence front. It was a karate movie shot in Japan, 1960, but really it was funded to root out communists in the Japanese film industry. I mean, he had a lot of that stuff there.
Wow.
But it's like, what's the story? And as we sort of talked over a couple of months, it was like, there's a very clear story from March of 73, when Five Fingers of Death came out and broke it all open, to Last Dragon, and then 85, 86, when sort of it was all done. It was all over, you know? And then you fast forward a couple of years to the late 80s, early 90s, as the Combat Zone, the Loop, you know, Times Square, all these neighborhoods that had grindhouses started getting gentrified. All these TV stations that were showing black belt theater and everything, they were starting to do infomercials, and it all ended. And so to me, it was like, we got a beginning, we got a middle, we got an end. This is a book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is a terrific book. I just can't recommend it highly enough. And you know, if you've clicked to listen to an episode about these movies, you're pretty much sold on it already. Okay, so gents, what films? Let's do them one at a time. What is the first film that you selected to discuss today?
Five Fingers of Death, because woo-hoo! that's like the ultimate, brick
ground zero.
Yeah, that's the poster of that movie was a fist breaking bricks. So
that is the movie where Tatum O'Neill, when she was on tour for doing press for Paper Moon, they said, what's your favorite movie? And she said, Five Fingers of Death.
All right. Well, let's watch a trailer.
Man, I need a clip of that for an intro to a movie podcast. I'm not even going to say which one.
The new movie sensation that's stunning the world. The martial arts masterpiece. Sights and sounds like never before.
Sights and sounds like never before.
It was literally stunning the world. Martial
arts. Yes.
See one incredible onslaught after the other. Come prepared for the thrill of a lifetime.
Often these trailers are hyperbole, but this is all pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Who do you want us to kill?
Just you concentrate on the leaders. The others won't give us any trouble.
See acts of incredible,
incredible savagery.
That's checked.
They're not lying.
Incredibly deadly. No. Unbelievably vicious.
I'm waiting to hear the Quincy Jones Ironside steal.
I think it was at the very beginning.
Was that? Yeah, I thought I heard it.
Yeah. There you go.
Yep.
See the astonishing ritual of the fires. Pale before the forbidden ritual of the steel palm.
Steel palm.
I often pale when I'm at the movies at something I see on screen.
You know, and it's funny, by the time this came out, Shaw had been doing this stuff for 5 years. Like, right. They were experts.
Yeah.
No one stood a chance with this movie. Warriors attack each other
with the most deadly weapons ever developed. Their bare hands. I miss voiceovers like these, man.
I know. Wait, Chris, who does the voiceover for this? Do you know?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know whose voice this is.
Adolf Caesar did a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But not this, definitely.
I mean, if there's not a beat down in a tea house, are you watching a kung fu movie?
Well, it's funny. I was looking back over the notes I made when I was watching. It's like, tea house looks breakable.
Yeah.
Action break down any second. Breakable tea houses.
Very much so. Oh, yeah. This is, they do show in the trailer maybe my favorite bit, which is the thing with the sword. Going into the, and then it breaks off. Perfect.
Oh, I always love the tearing out the dude's eyes.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, I mean, obviously, yes.
I mean, denucleating, I think, is a technical term. Yeah, exactly.
There you go. Five Fingers of Death from Warner Brothers. We'll get into all of this. But before we do, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about Five Fingers of Death in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
In 1973, this was the first Chinese martial arts film to hit America, starting the craze and paving the way for Bruce Lee classics. Picture has been mercilessly attacked for its poor dubbing and hokey plot, but I find it great fun to watch an extremely bland hero, Lo Li, take on a fabulous array of Chinese and Japanese villains, each more outrageous than his predecessor. These villains are all considered unbeatable in battle, but only Li possesses the mystical Iron Fist. Picture has flair, imagination at very least. It has great camp value. It would also make a good second feature to Inframan, directed by Ching Cheng Ho, also with Wang Ping, Wang Ching Fing. I sound like I'm making fun of people.
No, those are the names.
In the 80s schoolyard. I'm just saying, I am from Kansas. My pronunciation sucks, but that's what's written down.
There we go. All right,
appreciate that he was on board with that.
Mm-hmm. He is. Man, wait till you hear what he has to say about Enter the Dragon. So let's start with the big question. Why these two films in particular, when we sent you this list, why were these the ones you wanted to talk about?
Five Fingers of Death was the movie that kicked off the martial arts craze in the United States. And that's what our book is about. It's all about martial arts movies coming to the United States. And 1973 was the ground zero for that. The whole year pretty much, but definitely that the summer, Five Fingers of Death came out in three cities on March 21st, 1973, and was immediately a huge hit. It was number one at the box office two consecutive weeks, which is something.
Wow.
Enter the Dragon had 2 weeks at the top of the box office, but they were not consecutive.
Yeah.
So, that's a distinction right there. But it was the same studio, and I believe that the Warner Brothers picked it up because they wanted to test the waters, because they had Enter the Dragon, which had just completed filming. That was that was being made in January of 73.
And so, at that point, it was called Blood and Steel.
Right.
Which is a terrible title. I'm so glad they changed it.
It was Bruce Lee wanted Enter the Dragon. Yeah, he wanted that title.
Good. How many foreign films have been number one at the U.S. box office 2 weeks in a row, like ever?
Ever.
I mean, are there? Yeah.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm really trying to think about even something like Parasite that won the big awards didn't achieve that particular distinction, right? Am I just being dumb here?
No, you're right. I mean, 73 was the year when shit kicked off. I mean, so March was Five Fingers of Death. And I think, Chris, was it May that it was like the number one, two, and three spot were all Hong Kong movies?
I
it was Five Fingers
that,
of Death.
Yeah.
It was shortly after, yeah.
And what was the Angela Mao movie?
Deep Thrust. Yeah.
Number one, two, three. I mean, that's huge that Hong Kong movies, Hong Kong, a country, state, city, a colony of 6 million people, had the number one, two, and three movies at the American box office in May of 73.
incredible. So in terms of the background of this particular movie, you mentioned in the book that it was not like a huge runaway smash in Hong Kong when it came out.
Not at all.
Was there something special about this particular movie that made it cross over so well and hit so hard, or was it just a good movie at the right time?
We've actually never talked. Corey, what do you think? Because I've got an opinion, but I've never heard yours.
I think it was. It was not a new story for the Shaw Brothers because it's very close to Chinese Boxer and has some of the same cast members.
Most of the same cast.
and then they turned around and made another movie, Thunderbolt Fist, with another Korean director, and again, James Nam, who's the blinded student in Five Fingers, is the main villain in that one, and it's a very similar story. So, from the Shaw Brothers and I guess the Hong Kong perspective, there was nothing super special about it, but it came out at the right time because Kung Fu was doing really well, the ABC series with David Carradine.
Yeah.
And that had just like the last couple of months of 72 had gotten picked up as a regular weekly series. Because up until then, it was kind of sharing the time slot with Alias Smith and Jones. It was like every 3 weeks, I think, or something. So they just picked it up, I think, in December as a series because it was so popular. And it was appointment television for a lot of people. And so then this came out in March. And it was... a lot of things had been building up to its release, I think, because you had appearances of martial arts throughout 1972, like Superfly and Melinda and The Mechanic. You know, all three of those movies had training sessions in karate. Mm-hmm. So it had been building to this like throughout 1972. And this was like, you know, the floodgates, I think.
Yeah. And my point of view, because I think Chris is 100% dead on, and I would agree with everything he just said. And my point of view is very, from a Hong Kong perspective, Shaw Brothers have been doing martial arts movies like this since 67 with One Armed Boxer, which really revolutionized, hey, revenge, anger, young dudes fighting the system. And by the time they made King Boxer, which is what Five Fingers of Death was called before it was retitled, I mean, you're looking at a studio that was really firing on all cylinders. They'd had 5 years. When you watch Five Fingers of Death, it's a very dark movie. It's a very shadowy movie. One scene takes place entirely in the dark, except for like shafts of light. They are really, it's a sophisticated film in terms of technique. And I also love the fact it's an immigrant film. Lo Lee, who's the star, Chinese Indonesian, who is working in Hong Kong. Chung Chang-hwa, who directed it, is a Korean director who they hired because they were like, well, you seem to be able to do a shit ton with a low budget. Let's bring you on to Shaw. His famous quote was, Koreans, we get things done. But he had these things. You'll notice when you watch Five Fingers of Death, a lot of people punching at the lens. And he was like, yeah, I developed that technique in Korea because I could shoot it if the other actor didn't show up for the fight scene. I could, shoot.
I love that.
So this was a movie made by people who are maximizing their resources. And by the time, Shaw was a huge studio. So by the time this came around, 72 is when it was made in Hong Kong and released to little acclaim. And then 73 was when it released in the States. I mean, this would be like saying, if you lived in Czechoslovakia in the 50s and had never seen an MGM movie from the 40s and suddenly they released... and you're like, whoa, where is this coming from? This was a technically accomplished movie by a lot of artisans working at the top of their game. And if you're in New York, you are a kid, most likely, who's going to see an action movie. You're a young guy. You're probably not white. You're used to being screwed over and fucked over. Mm-hmm. It was, that was the New York City story. and you go and see a movie with not one white person in it, and instead it's people kicking ass, and it's not cheap. It's not a blaxploitation movie where you're, you know, constantly aware of the seams of the budget. You are seeing an accomplished feature film from a studio that feels like it's catering to you and your anger. Because those Shaw Brothers movies, I mean, since One Armed Swordsman in 67, anger was the primary emotion. You're going to see the hero humiliated, fight back, kill everyone, the end.
In terms of American reception, we'd been sending guys to Vietnam for 10 years at that point. Do you think they had seen some of these movies and like come back with a little bit of familiarity? I mean, did that impact it at all? Or am I just like placing my news segment
actually
over your movie segment?
No. Actually, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I don't know if they did or not, but we talked to RZA and Fab Five Freddy. They were talking about, well, Fab Five Freddy in particular, going to Jamaica and the West Indies to visit relatives. And these movies were playing down there in theaters and coming back to New York and telling their friends, we got to go to Chinatown because that's where they're showing these here. Like they were showing these stuff. This stuff is playing in Chinatowns all over the U.S. There was a 50 to 60 screen Chinatown circuit before 73, before Five Fingers of Death. And people were going down to see this stuff. And it was kids who would go visit their grandparents in Jamaica or the Bahamas and come back and say, oh, my God, this stuff rules.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know, but that makes a lot of sense about Vietnam. Like I visited my sister in Thailand in the 80s. Hong Kong movies were first run features. So I am assuming in Vietnam in the 70s, Hong Kong stuff was probably running.
Yeah. The thing you said about humiliation, you know, and that sort of arc really jumped out at me this time as I was watching this movie. Because like we mentioned, I'm working on this Die Hard book. I'm in this Die Hard space. And this idea that is very present in that movie as well of a main character who is vulnerable as opposed to who is this like unstoppable, invincible warrior.
That's the secret ingredient to Die Hard.
It is that in this movie, he gets his ass handed to him through the entire middle hour of the damn thing.
Yeah.
And as a result, just like in Die Hard, we relate more, we're pulling harder for a hero who is not invincible because that is, you know, we relate to that more directly.
Yeah.
And you know, Die Hard, they destroy his feet or they try to, you know, they shoot the glass. And so he has to bandage up his feet in both. I think Chinese Boxer, this movie, and Thunderbolt Fist, they destroy the hands, I think. Definitely this one and Thunderbolt Fist. Yeah, so, it goes beyond humiliation. You're just trying to destroy the person.
What year was Crippled Avengers, Chris? Was that 78?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Shaw Brothers movie where every single main character, I've been blinded. I've been like had my tongue cut out and been rendered deaf. Like I've had constricting bands around my skull, so my brain's been destroyed. I've had my feet cut off. Like this idea of your body can be destroyed and force of will bring you back, I think was tremendously relatable to a kid living in New York in 73 who's like, I love my dad. I love my mom. I see them go to work every day. They come home. They cry. They can't make things work. We get hassled by cops. You know what I mean? Like everything is a humiliation and we're trying so hard. And then to see this, like, no, try harder. Will win.
And also the genius of that sequence that you mentioned, the scene that's in the dark, is that it's not just that's a stylistic choice or something like that. Like that's a narrative choice. That's the guy who has been blinded has the advantage in that dark room. Genius. And you see the big bad's eyes and that little shaft of light. It's a perfect, perfect little sequence.
And also, you know, the amazing thing about the movie is it ends on a bummer. I mean, Lowly kills everyone. And this is sort of par for the course for these Shaw Brothers wuxia movies and martial arts movies. The hero kills everyone at the end. Then he kind of stumbles off into the quasi-apocalyptic sunset, you know, that nuclear orange glow with his, like, hands broken. He's bleeding from multiple wounds. It's like, he going to be okay in 20 minutes or just face down in a gutter? Yeah.
It's not very heroic. And you like sort of expect after, even though he hasn't really been treated very heroically throughout the whole thing, you sort of think he's fucking earned it for the credit sequence at least.
Yeah.
Nah, they don't give it to him. It's a fascinating choice, but it really works.
Well, and that was a really different thing when, especially in the 80s, when American martial arts movies started becoming big, like the ninja films, first off with Shokasugi, Enter the Ninja, Return of the Ninja, all that, but also the arena fighting movies like Bloodsport and Best of the Best that had to have these triumphant endings.
Right. The Rocky ending.
Yeah, the Rocky ending. Even though Rocky is qualified the way a Shaw,
excuse me, the Rocky 2, 3, 4 ending.
Yes, exactly.
The Rocky sequel ending. There we go.
Rocky 1, I would say, is a Shaw Brothers movie. Rocky 2, 3, 4 are American
good
movies.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, friends, let's talk about the release and reception of Five Fingers of Death, which, as we mentioned, was released in New York City on March 21, 1973. Same day as the film adaptation of Godspell, by the way, a show I did in high school. Also playing in New York on that day, Jack Lemmon in Save the Tiger, James Caan in Slither, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor in Under Milkwood, Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw in The Getaway, Robert Downey Sr.'s Greaser's Palace, the ever-popular Billy Jack, which I feel like is probably also a piece of that sort of stoking the fire
100%.
For martial arts movies.
Absolutely.
And, this is my favorite, Roger Corman's American release of Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers.
Yeah.
Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
March 21, 1973 was the day William R. Merriam, a VP at International Telephone and Telegraph, testified in front of a Senate subcommittee about colluding with the CIA to overthrow the democratically elected president of Chile, Salvador Allende.
Ah,
Yeah, this is a terrible story, and I hate it. And you can guarantee the people who did it didn't want there to be a Senate fucking subcommittee or anybody testifying or anything of that nature. So that's good, at least. There's a great podcast called Real Dictators that has a good series on Allende if you'd like to know more. But even over six episodes, they don't shit on the CIA enough, in my opinion.
Fair.
G. Gordon Liddy was already in prison, but Watergate was still on the front page. Mm-hmm. Patrick Gray III told senators that Attorney General Richard G. Kleindienst, I don't know if I got his name right, but fuck him anyway, told him he wasn't allowed to talk about Watergate anymore. Isn't that what sunk their ship in the first place, the not talking?
Yeah,
I mean, other than the original thing, right? Nah, they had learned no lessons by March of 73. And finally, the president of Cambodia shut down a bunch of newspapers who were reporting on military successes by a fringe group called the Khmer Rouge.
Sounds like it won't take.
Yeah.
We don't look ahead on the news on this show, so I have no idea how that went. But good luck to the people of Cambodia. Jason, what did the critics say about Five Fingers of Death?
In Newsweek, Paul D. Zimmerman wrote, quote, "This is the first movie by Hong Kong moguls Run Run Shaw and Run Me Shaw to be distributed by a major American company for U.S. general distribution. Accordingly, it has been dubbed by English-speaking actors of every intonation and audibility. And like all the Shaw sagas, it looks as if it has been made for the price of an egg roll." Not sure I agree with that. But it delivers dazzling Donnybrooks with metronomic regularity. That's a good line. About every 6 minutes, with big guys in pajamas bounding up toward the ceiling and cracking open one another's craniums as though they were empty crocs, which, judging from the dialogue, they are. However, the New York Times party pooper Roger Greenspun complained, "I don't know much about karate, but I know what I don't like." See, you thought he was going to do the James Brown thing, didn't you?
I know, Karazor.
Yeah. "And the karate in Five Fingers of Death, for all its slow motion high leaps, its grunts, its whooshing fists, has the look of the bottom of the barrel. It is all too extravagant, too gratuitously wild, as if composed for show rather than for attack, defense, or any real purpose." I don't know what he thinks a movie is. That's my takeaway.
It's all extravagant and for show. That sounds like a movie.
Yeah. That does. That does. Except it looks like the bottom of a barrel. So what?
Also that.
How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
As Grady and Chris point out, in These Fists Break Bricks, Five Fingers didn't make much noise in Hong Kong, where it didn't even make the year-end top 10. But Five Fingers was a massive hit in America, raking in more than $10 million in worldwide rentals by the fall. It didn't win any awards of note, but what do you expect? Quick quiz. Do you think if somebody asked them, hey, do you want to be number 12 on the Hong Kong list and number 1 on the US list for the year, or swap that, which do you think they would have chosen? I think they would have chosen number 500 on the Hong Kong list, right? And swap for number 1 in the States? Come on.
Oh, absolutely. And also, for Shaw, for anyone in Hong Kong, it was inconceivable their movies would do this well in the U.S. That their movies would be number 1? Are you kidding?
Right.
$10 million. This movie was made, Chris, tell me if I'm wrong. I think this movie was made for around $30,000 U.S.
Oh, my God.
I think it was in the book. It's in a caption, I believe. It's $23,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, this movie was made for peanuts, but it was part of a studio system, right? So costs can be different. But let's say it was made for 100,000 U.S. Let's bump that up 3 times just like to say, hey, the director's contract and all that. And it made $10 million worldwide in 1973, when $10 million was probably $200 million, you know, in today's money. Mm-hmm. That's insane. I don't think anyone in Hong Kong dreamed of that.
Well, and as always gets pointed out, because we have this conversation around Deep Throat, which came out, you know, around the same time and sort of kicked off Porno Chic and all that. And there's always an asterisk on, you know, the amount of money that movie made, because who fucking knows? It's all being run by gangsters. It's all fucking like nickels and dimes.
Weren't they weighing the money?
Right. Like, to assume that the accounting was like was dead on is, you know.
Well, also Warner's gave a percentage to Shaw Brothers. They didn't buy it. They were like, they put no money up front. They were like, look, and I, Chris, do you know what the percentage was? I don't.
I don't either. I think we just had that it was a percentage deal. But,
yeah.
You know.
20-30%?
Yeah.
The incentives to underreport are literally at every stage.
Yes. And just out of curiosity, because I, you know, one of the great things on the, I saw this, I'm very late to this particular title. I didn't see it until the Shaw Scope Volume 1 Arrow Blu-ray set came out a couple of years ago.
What did you
ago.
Think when you saw it?
I loved it. I mean, I was quite taken with it right away, you know, and my Kung Fu journey has been extremely late. You know, I saw
Nothing
the essentials. I saw the essentials early on. I saw the Bruce Lee movies. I saw, you know, the sort of golden era of Jackie Chan, but that was kind of it. And then during lockdown, I got into you know, there was a really cool program of early Jackie Chan on the Criterion Collection or on the Criterion Channel, like right at the beginning of lockdown. Mm-hmm. And I watched all of those and I was like, this is an interesting director. I like what he does. And then honestly, the book was not long after that. And since I read the book, I've made an effort to really track these things down and grab, you know, it's been a golden era for Kung Fu. If you're a physical media collector, like they're spitting out Shout and Arrow, both spitting out these collections like quicker than I can buy them. So every night, like once a week, Thursday nights, I sit down and watch a Kung Fu movie that I haven't seen.
What's yours? Michael. No, I was saying.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Mike, your background on Kung Fu.
Well, look, I don't want to stick up for Paul Zimmerman or anything, but I think like if you see these movies for the first time as like a grown person who's used to writing about Ingmar fucking Bergman, it might be a little bit hard to sort of tap into it. I mean, I saw all of these movies when I was a kid, and I can't tell you when or where or what they were called because they all bleed together. But I grew up in the era of VCRs. And, you know, like kids who are into fucking Ninja Stars, bro. Like, I saw all of these at one point or another and didn't really, like, pay much attention or know anything about them. And then when I was 19, 20, I lived with a guy named Tuan outside of St. Louis. And we got White Castle and Chinese food and watched Kung Fu movies all the time. Like, Tuan had a, you know, there was a video store down the street. They had, I don't know how many Kung Fu movies, more than we could possibly watch. And that was literally all he brought home ever, Kung Fu movies. And so the first time, like, I recall seeing the hands and the dun-da-da, like, you know, that's, I'm 19 or 20. It's like 95 or so. And you know, like Jason's saying about the physical media, by 1995, video stores and video in like VHS had made so much money for so many people that they were pretty deep in the list of Shaw Brothers and stuff like that. And even if it wasn't being officially released, blah, 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 you know, but Tuan was one of those guys who, like, you know, he had seen the Bruce Lee movie so many times that he was excited to show you anything else. And so that's a lot of the movies that, like, I think I've never seen before. And then I'll put it on and I'll be like, oh, yeah. And you know exactly what's going to happen all the way through to the end. So, yeah, shout out to Tuan for introducing me to that. But I think, like, that's when you see him when you're a kid. You don't the pajamas, the fucking the off sink, all that shit. Like you sort of get over you get over the sort of jokes pretty
quickly.
And you find what's there because you're not like an old guy who's used to writing about Ingmar Bergman. And shout out to him. I'm that guy now. But thankfully, I got these movies, first before I got stodgy.
Wait, Chris, I've never asked you, when's the first time you saw Five Fingers?
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
It was on bootleg tape in the late 80s.
Okay.
I've heard of it when the first time I heard the title was on Siskel and Ebert. They did a special of movies that changed the movies. And these were movies that
that's they impressive. Felt
changed movies like during their time as critics. So they both came up like in the late 60s. So they talked about Jaws, Vixen, Sweet Sweet Back, Easy Rider. And then at the end of the episode, they called out Spot the Wonder Dog and they said, we have to mention the granddaddy of dogs, which is Five Fingers of Death. And they said that this movie inspired like every kung fu movie that we have seen, you know, since then. And they showed a clip of it and you know, they talked about how devoted the fans are to the genre and how like most of the movies that came out after it were junk, but yeah, but they gave it a shout out. And,
good for them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Grady, when did you first see this one?
For the book.
I
knew Shaw Brothers stuff really well. I'd seen tons of stuff and this was one, I knew it. I knew its reputation. And when we started writing the book, I was like, I need to sit down and watch King Boxer.
Wow.
I never watched it before all the way through. And it blew my mind.
What'd you think?
Oh, I thought it was amazing. You know, like, this is an incredible film. Like, but also, this is a high-end B-list Shaw Brothers production made at the top of their technical expertise. Yeah. But it doesn't have a big star. Lo Lee became a big star after this. Like he was sort of bottom of the barrel in Shaw Brothers hierarchy. He wasn't Jimmy Wong Yu. He wasn't David Chang. He wasn't T Lung.
Right.
And he wasn't Ching Quan Tai. And like, you know, so yeah, it took me a long time to come around to it. And when I watched, I was like, I don't understand how a Shaw Brothers movie this sophisticated in terms of technical stuff and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a smart bomb designed to destroy audiences.
Yeah, yes. Well put. Well put. Okay, on that note, let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about the rest of our double feature. All right, fellas, what other film did you select to discuss today?
Oof. Chris, introduce it.
Enter the Dragon, Bruce Lee's final completed film, a big box office hit of 1973, which I'm sure he envisioned from the start would elevate him to the level of Steve McQueen, his frenemy, as we called him in the book. It was a highly anticipated release, and then Bruce Lee died.
He died before it came out.
About a month earlier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, let's watch a trailer.
On a mysterious island in the South China Sea,
there is a fortress without walls.
It actually has walls.
That's true. They're showing the walls right now. It's a little disingenuous.
Welcome to the Island of Han.
Which wasn't that an original title of this? When it was a Western script, Island of Han?
Was it?
That's an even worse original title than Blood and Sand.
Yeah. Because Blood originally it was... Kelsey. Yes, it was Kelsey. You're right. Which means nothing. Oh, Saxon comes first? Are you kidding me?
Oh, nope. Nope. There he is, not too convincingly kicking, yeah.
Introducing U.S. karate champion Jim Kelly as Williams. Wow.
Introducing. And knew what it meant to fight for survival. That's a pretty great scene where he kicks the cops' asses.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Pretty. Kind of a timeless feel-good sort of scene. And starring Black Belt Hall of Fame, undisputed martial arts champion,
and international film star Bruce Lee. What was the name of Jim Kelly's school, Chris? 105th Street School?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. You see at the beginning of the movie, which was the center of black martial arts in America.
Oh, okay.
The Resistance.
Well, that was wasn't that the Black Karate Federation?
Yeah, that was the Black Karate Federation. And it's Steve Muhammad, who has a cameo.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah. And Donnie Williams also is in that scene.
Donnie Williams, yeah. The
beautiful and treacherous. Dum 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 dum. Got it. Like we we gotta mention just lost Lalo Schifrin a few short days ago.
Yeah.
Man, this is a great score.
Mm-hmm. I was having a fight with someone recently where I was like, I think John Williams has made a lot of money from his music royalties. I think Lalo Schifrin might have made more because of the Mission Impossible.
He very well may have.
Sure. Yep.
There you go. Lady from Shanghai, shout out. Love that.
Yeah. Yep. He's in it for the money. Well, and that's the big thing they talk about when they were shooting this. When they shot that Hall of Mirrors fight sequence at the end, the set was falling apart. It was not air conditioned. Wow. It was hot. People were they were like, this is the last thing we're shooting, and it's done. Like this, we're broke. This production is broken, and we're gonna take the footage back and try to make it make sense. Wow. And they shot it and took it back, and they're like, "We got Matt lightning in a bottle."
Yeah, holy crap! Oh, the human
bare hands.
There you go. By Warner Brothers. It's just like, it's so, it is such, you know, like both at the beginning of this and that Arrow Blu-ray has the alternate, you know, the Five Fingers of Death opening. To see that, you know, that 70s Warner's logo, man, it's like, it's such
legitimacy
that it confers. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how did they, I'm sorry, let's do the capsule and then we'll start there. Mike, what does Danny say about Enter the Dragon in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says, arguably the most entertaining, colorful, and spectacular kung fu film ever made.
Ooh.
Kung fu master Bruce Lee arrives on the island owned by Han Shi Qin, an evil Dr. No-like figure with an attachable iron hand. As a participant in Han's martial arts tournament, Lee hopes to find evidence that Han deals drugs and traffics prostitutes. He also suspects that Han's right-arm man, Ohata, Bob Wall, was responsible for the death of his sister, played in flashback by the lovely queen of kung fu movies, Angela Mao Ying. The story is on a comic book level, but the production values are high, the action is nonstop and consistently exciting, and the atmosphere is rich. The shots of crowded Hong Kong are particularly evocative. And there's an all-star cast of sorts with American imports John Saxon hiding from the mob, Jim Kelly hiding from the U.S. police, the lone black in the film, and Wall joining Chinese kung fu stars Yang Zi, the Chinese Hercules. Ying and the incomparable Li, whose feats seem impossible.
Fair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unlike his movie rivals, Li, the actor, exploited his sexuality, stripping off his shirt to reveal his rippling muscles, posing for battle with legs spread, knees slightly bent, hands on thighs. Somehow he looks relaxed and tense at the same time. Suddenly his hands thrust forward and his fingers penetrate flesh. His legs shoot upward and crack bone, and he emits a piercing "Kai!" fighting yell. It's actually written there that I wasn't just trying to get excited. In his incredible acrobatic fight with O'Hara, he does several flip kicks and his famous lightning one-inch paralyzing punches. His opponent's death takes place off-screen, where Lee's feet destroy his windpipe, while an incredible slow-motion close-up allows us to see Li's facial muscles quivering like the waves in the ocean.
What's I just gotta up, say, Danny this is
Perry? Wow.
This is one of the capsules where you could tell that Perry is also a screenwriter or also a sports writer. Like you could totally see it.
Lee's climactic fight in a hall of mirrors out of the lady from Shanghai with Han, who wears blades in place of his missing hand, is unforgettable. Film is flawed. There is no time element, for instance, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. An enormous moneymaker worldwide, directed by American Robert Klaus, music by Lalo Schifrin, also with Anna Capri, Betty Chung, and Jeffrey Weeks.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Danny Perry.
Man, he was excited to write that one. In his very first draft of notes for the book, this fucking movie was in the list. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Well, you know,
good for you, Danny Perry.
The whole section about him describing the sexuality of Bruce Lee and everything, that's word for word from the cult movies book. The first cult movies book, he wrote a chapter and he goes into detail about those flaws that he refers to in this book, like the time element. I mean, one of his big complaints, probably his main complaint, is that there's no ticking clock. To the story.
Not wrong. Okay, I want to go back to this Warner Brothers piece. Like how were they smart enough to get in early on this and to distribute both of these huge movies?
Their
head of, or I don't know if he at this point if he was the head of international releasing and or international, you know, the Department of International Films. There was a gentleman there named Wolf Cohen. For years he had worked for Warner Brothers, and I think he was born in 1900, so at this point he was like semi-retired. Wow. He was working independently. He was 73, and he had been with Warners, I think, first in Canada, and then he had bounced around. He had done some freelance stuff, like for other companies, like for Toho and other Hong Kong companies. But he had been either at Warners or affiliated with Warners for like 50 years, and he was really good friends with Run Run Shaw, to the point where he was the best man when Run Run Shaw's daughter was married in 1962 or 63 in Hawaii, in Honolulu.
Oh, wow.
She married a businessman. I forgot if he worked. He worked for a big investment company that had an office in Honolulu, and he was her husband. So Run Run Shaw's son-in-law was like the first official distributor of Shaw Brothers movies in the US, but it was just Honolulu. Mm-hmm. So that was like his entree into the United States distribution of Shaw Brothers movies. But shortly after that wedding, they opened up a theater or they leased a theater that was a Shaw Brothers theater in Honolulu. But Wolf Cohen went back, I don't know how many years before that, they were friendly enough to, you know, for him to be present at that wedding. So he was the Shaw Brothers guy in the continental U.S. For a long time. And he had tried other deals before that. I know that One-Armed Swordsman, which Grady mentioned a little while ago, was extremely popular in Chinatown theaters to the point where the ads, even though Chinatown theaters usually didn't advertise in newspapers like the San Francisco Chronicle or the Daily News in New York, there were ads for like the Music Palace showing One-Armed Swordsman. And a lot of people were going to see that. And Wolf Cohen made a deal with MGM to distribute One-Armed Swordsman. And it didn't get released in the U.S. I have a theory about that because that was around the time that James Aubrey took over and started slashing budgets, shelving movies and everything. And you know, taking movies away from directors and recutting them. But it did, MGM did release it in South America. And it, so you will see 27x41 one sheets of One-Armed Swordsman with the MGM logo on it. So he was with Shaw for a long time, and he's the one who orchestrated this. The Five Figures.
Well, and all, for Five Figures, definitely. But also with Enter the Dragon, you know, it's not a Shaw movie. It's Golden Harvest, which was Shaw's rival, who were started by disgruntled Shaw employees who left. And they were very, and I don't know why. I think the reason they latched on to Warner Brothers is because Bruce Lee had a history with Warner Brothers. He was pitching them projects. And
he was in Marlowe, which was a Warner Brothers release.
That was it. Yeah. And, you know, Raymond Chow sent a print of The Big Boss or Fist of Fury.
Yes.
Not Fist. Yeah, right. Or was it Fist? But wait, which was it, Chris?
Well, Fist of Fury became Chinese Connection. And then The Big Boss became Fists, plural, of Fury.
Yeah. Exactly. But like he sent a print to Fred Weintraub at Warner. And then Raymond Chow got pissed off that he never heard back from Weintraub. And he sold the rights, the dubbed English rights for Bruce Lee's early movies to another studio. But Fred Weintraub had taken that print to go upstairs to Ted Ashley and other people at Warner's to be like, this guy, Bruce Lee, he's got it. We got to do something with him. And so this deal to make Enter the Dragon or Blood and Steel or whatever you want to call it, Kelsey, whatever it was going to be called, was going on for years. And in the meantime, Bruce Lee made The Big Boss. He made Fist of Fury, and he made Way of the Dragon. And with each movie, he took more control over the film and the choreography and eventually directing himself. So by the time you get to Enter the Dragon, Bruce Lee's like, I am not a contract actor. I am a star. Right. And that's why, you know, his name had Dragon in it. And he was like, it's got to be called Enter the Dragon. Mm-hmm. And Warner Brothers really pushed back on that and finally gave in. And I got to say it, I'm not a Bruce Lee fan as an individual, but I really appreciate Bruce Lee as a human being. Mm. He was right, as he often was. He was annoying. He was obnoxious. He was an egotist. He was messed up, but he was right.
Yeah. So when did each of you first see Enter the Dragon?
Oh, man. Chris, you go.
I saw it on home video, with the Warner videotape. And so it was maybe 1983. Okay. I rented it. And then a friend of mine who was taking karate lessons, this is like maybe a month later, he told me, hey, my school, they're going to be showing karate movies. Do you want to come over and watch them? So I went over there, and it turned out they weren't showing karate movies. They were showing one kung fu movie. And it ended up being Enter the Dragon, which I just watched, but I loved it, so I watched it again. Again, you know, I knew about Bruce Lee, I don't think that was the first one that I saw. I think I rented Chinese Connection first and saw that first.
Which is Way of the Dragon, right?
Chinese Connection is Fist of Fury.
Fist of Fury.
Fist singular, yeah.
Yep. Grady, when did you first see this one?
You know, it's funny. I am not a Bruce Lee guy. Like, I just don't. it's just not my vibe.
Sure.
I worked on a project in Hong Kong many years ago, 2012, where someone wanted to do a Bruce Lee biopic. And I was like, okay, sure. I mean, working on a movie, I'm in. And sure. That really, like, learning sort of about him and his life, really, I was like, you know what? This guy was a grinder. And there is, and we could talk about this in a minute, but like, Enter the Dragon is an amazing and singular exploitation movie. I mean, it really does capture lightning in a bottle. And Bruce Lee really is a big part of that. And his career should not have happened for a lot of reasons. And that was around the time I watched Enter the Dragon. And I was like, this is the real deal. Like, but yeah, like Chris, it was that old Warner video. I think it was the 25th anniversary one or something.
Something. Mm. You know, this is one, and I'll just say this offhand. We occasionally have talked on our show or shows about the weird phenomenon where sometimes you see the parody before you see the thing.
Kentucky Fried Movie. I saw that years before I saw Enter the Dragon. And it's
full again. Yeah.
It's the best part of that movie.
It is. It's terrific, but it really is crazy because it is like a beat for beat parody. Like it's very precise in that. Yeah. I guess my question is Robert Klaus a good director?
Oh boy.
Cause I have thoughts, but I'd like to hear yours.
where are you on this actually?
He can be.
Okay.
He could be. That's fair. Yeah. He could be a very good director. There are moments in Enter the Dragon that I think are really special, and I really like the movie he made a few years before Enter the Dragon, Darker Than Amber, which was
Darker Than Amber,
which has that
great
fight scene that got him.
It sure does.
Bruce Lee was so impressed by that fight scene that
he
suggested Klaus. But I mean, other things, you know, that he's directed, it's just it's hard to believe it's the same person.
right. That's the thing. I've occasionally been hoodwinked into watching something and seeing his name and saying, oh, that might be good. And then I've turned out to be very wrong. I think what was really striking in watching these two back to back to prep for this was that this one, Five Fingers, just seems so much lighter on its feet, that this one is pretty formal stylistically, and that one, Five Fingers, they're using wild flourishes, handheld camera and snap zooms, and just really kind of going nuts with it. What I find myself feeling every time I watch Enter the Dragon, and I've seen it a few times now, is I come away from it feeling like I like it, but the things that keep me from loving it feel like they might be the reasons, part of the reason why it was such a huge hit. To the extent that, like, it feels like, here, America, we are introducing you to this star and this kind of movie, but we're going to wrap it around these other elements that you're comfortable with. You know, we're going to give you a blaxploitation thread. We're going to give you this white guy who can be your stand-in if you're a white person watching it. And that so much of it feels more like a Bond movie than a Bruce Lee movie.
Oh, like, 100%.
Purposefully, I'm sure. But I mean, like, literally the villain's like stroking a cat as he's like showing off his, you know, his collection of atrocities. And so I guess I'm curious how much you think the sort of familiar elements were helpful for that initial audience to sort of take in the thing, the elements that were not quite so familiar with to them.
I think it's kind of, it's a little similar to the selling of Kung Fu to American audiences, because Kung Fu was a Western, and Western shows were on the downslide. Just like Western movies, but to make it a little more palatable, like not palatable, but a little familiar to the American audiences, it was a Western, and that's what it replaced in that time slot, was a Western. So here what you have is a Kung Fu movie that is kind of a James Bond. You know, and you know, that Schifrin score Yeah, it does
have. It is a Bond score.
Yeah.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It is. It 100% is.
I've seen this movie so many times and started seeing it so young. I met a guy named Jay Jacoby when I was 12 years old who introduced me to this and Akira and Lobo Comics and Milk and Cheese and like all the fucking cool shit that was coming out that like was going to be real cool in like 3 or 4 more years. Like met Jay when I was 12 and he introduced me to everything. I've seen this movie so many times and at such a young age that like at all the shit you guys just said never even fucking occurred to me. I've just watched. It's just like it's in like, I don't know, like something your mom makes that you didn't realize had cinnamon in it.
Right.
Until like you're in your mid 30s. I don't know. Like all the shit you guys said just made sense. It's not like all of that is like, what kind of bullshit is this? Whatever. It's all really there. I just found this thing pre-intellectual.
Yeah. And
it has just stayed there. Yeah. Like the way other people might put on a Star Wars movie to go to sleep or some shit. Like this is my shit that way. Mm-hmm. You know,
it is one of the great exploitation movies of all time. And Robert Klaus, good director, bad director. I got to say, John Saxon, he's really good in this. But Bruce Lee is, for an actor who did not show up for the first 3 weeks of shooting, because he was so terrified and stressed out that like he was going to screw up his big chance. And then on top of that, I mean, and his performance is incredibly charismatic. It is the, whether you like Bruce Lee, this is the ultimate Bruce Lee movie. And then you've got Jim Kelly, who was never this good again.
Nope.
You know, and maybe that's because of Jim Kelly, but maybe it's also Robert Klaus. Like, Jim Kelly is charismatic. He's cool. He's kick-ass. I mean, he is so good. When he dies, it's such a loss to the movie because he's so charming and personable and so great. I mean, this movie really is a showcase. And to your point, it's a movie that's like, now we've got this fighter. Now we've got this fighter. Now we've got this fighter. And it literally is introducing these people to American audiences.
Yep. Well said. All right. Well, on that note, let's talk about the release and reception of Enter the Dragon, which opened in New York City on August 17th, 1973, less than a month, as we mentioned, after Bruce Lee's untimely death. Also showing in NYC on that day, Jesus Christ Superstar, Westworld, White Lightning, The Day of the Jackal, the aforementioned Paper Moon, Cleopatra Jones, Live and Let Die, Behind the Green Door, and one of my personal Fun City favorites, Cops and Robbers. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
Man, I usually don't try to, I usually try not to bust Jason's chops when there's little typos in the notes, but he left a comma out between Live and Let Die, Behind the Green Door, and like... Now I want to
see
that
it.
Movie desperately.
I want that movie.
I want to see that.
Now
yeah.
I want Bond to show up to Behind the Green Door and all the women are like, you think you're a whore? Get the fuck in here. I'll show that Bond what's up, fucking these British people. Go. They don't know how to fuck. What are we talking about? Oh, opening day headlines.
Yeah.
August 17th, 1973 was just a few months later. And unfortunately, the news was still incredibly bad.
Huh,
Jeb Stuart Magruder was deputy director of the Committee for the Re-Election of the President, but on this day...
Creep!
He was
it's called Creep! I remember that from all the President's Men. It's called Creep.
Oh, yeah.
But on this day, he wasn't nothing but a felon pleading guilty to his scumbag nature. Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Right next to the pic of Magruder on the front page of the New York Times looking shady as fuck is a headline that says, Nixon aides sure he has deflated Watergate issue.
Oh, great.
I'll be interested to hear how that worked out for him when we do a later episode, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
31-year-old actor-model Bruce Pitour was robbed in his West Village apartment by Edward Garcia, age 29, for a total of $40. Now, this is actually somewhat connected to all these movie things we've been talking about here, right?
All right.
In the course of the robbery, Garcia stabbed Pitour 4 times in his own house. But not to be outdone, Pitour shot Garcia in the chest with a snub-nosed 38. Both men died right there in the apartment while Pitour's wife watched and screamed. What? A lot of good that fucking gat did you, huh, Charles Bronson? I just like, We've heard a lot of stories about Fun City and New York, and that is the everybody yeah. need, that's the story people need to start telling to illustrate how fucked up New York was in the 1970s. And finally, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was using their massive resources and know-how to do what? Cure cancer?
Mm-hmm.
Send a dog to Mars? Something fun, right? No, absolutely not. On August 17, 1973, the USSR announced to the world that Sesame Street is an American propaganda meant to spread Western values to unsuspecting peoples all over the world. I just want to point that out. If you're trying to shut down Sesame Street because it's too politically, you're basically a Red Army flunky. So fucking congrats, loser. Jason, what did the critics have to say about Enter the Dragon?
Well, this one got a much kinder review in the Times via Howard Thompson, who wrote, quote, from the opening, a stunning evocation of Hong Kong centering on the harbor, the crisp dialogue of Michael Allen's script, and the pounding pulse of Robert Klaus's direction spur the action forward without an ounce of fat. On an adventure level, the performances are quite good. The one by Mr. Lee, not only the picture's supermaster killer, but a fine actor as well, is downright fascinating. Mr. Lee, who also staged the combats, died very recently. Here he could not be more alive. In time,
wow, that's a good line.
It's a real good line. Yeah. Howard Thompson kind of brought it. In time, future Martin Scorsese collaborator Jay Cox was similarly enthusiastic. Quote, shot in Hong Kong by Warner Brothers, Enter the Dragon is made in English with Hollywood expertise and a certain rather lighthearted affection for the excesses and silliness of the whole kung fu genre. During one of the hero's few moments of repose, he advises a pupil who wants to learn the secrets of personal combat, feel, don't think. With that injunction in mind, the movie can be flat-out fun, a sort of carnival of combat that can turn even a sophisticated audience into a group of gawking kids at a Saturday matinee, end quote. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
It just made a shitload of money.
On sure did.
On an $850,000 budget, it grossed $25 million in the U.S. upon its initial release, was re-released on multiple occasions, racked up more money in overseas markets, and by 2001, it was estimated to have grossed over $400 million worldwide. A pretty good return on investment. Again, no awards of note, but who needs awards when you've grossed over $400 million? Your little statue would just be buried in your bag of money anyway.
Although I will say, by the time Bruce Lee died, he was obsessed with outgrossing his frenemy Steve McQueen, and he had not outgrossed his frenemy Steve McQueen. The Getaway was actually, Enter the Dragon would go on to make much more money.
Right.
But released in August of 73 and kept running. But by the end of 73, Getaway, Steve McQueen's movie had beaten it. And I always feel bad for that. That Bruce Lee, who's a legend, I mean, and deservedly so, died feeling like he still hadn't beat Steve McQueen.
Look, you're in Hong Kong. You've heard enough Buddhist talk to know that even if he did beat Steve McQueen, the next day he would have come up with some other bullshit to be upset about. You know how this cycle works, Grady. You know what's
up. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, Grady, where can people follow you on social media and or read your work?
So you just go to GradyHendrix.com. That's Hendrix with an X. But for this book, it's TheseFistsBreakBricks.com. And that's where everything is. And Chris and I are updating it as often as we can. We said daily, but maybe every other day with weird stuff that didn't fit in the book.
There we go. Chris, where can people find you on the internets?
They can find me at TheseFistsBreakBricks.com. Also, I'm on Facebook. And I do check my Temple of Schlock email about once or twice a month. I haven't updated the blog in a long time, but I can be reached there as well. But the other two are better ways to reach me.
So yeah, the book is out now again. That is These Fists Break Bricks, How Kung Fu Movies Swept America and Changed the World. I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's beautifully put together, full of great posters and images, and the text is it's a whole damn film history that you may not know about. So pick that up. Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
On a tiny chicken ranch in rural Washington. Tiny ranch, normal-sized chickens.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please leave us a rating and or review on whatever podcatcher you got us on. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get weekly show notes and such, you can do that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. And if you're one of those weirdos who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, hello friends, find us on YouTube on our channel, Guide for the Film Fanatic.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. Yes, and indeed. Shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, who taught us a very important lesson. Don't think, feel.
Thank you again, Grady and Chris.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Join us next time when podcaster extraordinaire Liam Billingham joins us to discuss Milos Forman's The Fireman's Ball. See you then.